From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is acclaimed journalist Douglas Murray, author of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
And welcome to another Hank Unplugged podcast, the podcast that's dedicated to bringing you the most interesting, informative, inspirational people on the planet, and also promoting books that I feel are absolutely must reading. I want to say at the outset of this podcast that Western civilization is in the midst of a massive crowd derangement crisis. The grand meta-narratives of religious truth and political order are, well, I would say they're in an utter state of collapse. And filling the void is a new religious dogma of social justice, identity politics, and intersectionality. Truth itself is routinely sacrificed on the altars of this unholy trinity. And one quick example before we get to our guest. It's an illustration of how students in the West increasingly perceive truth. And here's how some of the students talk about it. This is a quote that comes directly from The Madness of Crowds, in which students write this: "The idea that there is a single truth, or the truth, is a construct of the Euro-West, a construct that is deeply rooted in the Enlightenment." Of course, the Enlightenment was a movement that also described black and brown people as both subhuman and impervious to pain. This construction is a myth, and white supremacy, imperialism, capitalism, and the United States of America are all its progeny. The idea that truth is an entity for which we must search in matters that endanger our abilities to exist in open spaces is an attempt to silence oppressed people. In other words, truth is a fabrication by white people constructed for the subjugation of black and brown people. And this idea has become so entrenched that white professors now often begin their lectures by asking forgiveness for the very fact that they are white. There's one example in the book of a professor. Her name is Robin D'Angelo. She's of Boston University, and she begins one of her talks by saying, "I'd like to be a little less white," which means a little less oppressive, oblivious, defensive, ignorant, and, of course, arrogant. This new orthodoxy is pontificating that genders are fluid, that women are better than men, that people can become white, but they can't become black, and that anyone who doesn't believe in all of this is an oppressor. So Douglas Murray, in the book Madness of Crowds, talks about all of these subjects and more. He talks about what it means to be gay, the new orthodoxy on gayness. He writes about the underpinnings of Marxism in social systems. Not the least of these social systems are constituted by universities. He talks about the confusing messages bandied about with respect to the identity of women, the impact of technology on societal structures, the codification of entire groups of people based solely on their racial characteristics, and so much more. He even writes about the liabilities of forgiveness in an age in which the internet militates against that very thing. And in terms of the present madness of crowds, little has become more useful than the transgender battering ram, which is now being used to break down the last vestiges of what is perceived to be the great patriarchal wall of Western civilization. Well, Douglas Murray, he's a Renaissance man, quite frankly. He's a best-selling author. He's an award-winning journalist. He's based in Britain. He's the associate editor of The Spectator. And he has written regularly for publications like The Wall Street Journal, which I read cover to cover every single day, The Times, The National Review. His books include a really significant book titled The Strange Death of Europe. And I would say incidentally, or maybe not incidentally, that this book was almost 20 weeks on the Sunday Times bestseller list, and it was the number one bestseller in nonfiction. That's an incredible barrier to overcome, to become number one in nonfiction. And his latest book, and that's the book that I want to spend most of my time on today, is titled The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, Identity. Douglas, it is wonderful to have you on Hank Unplugged.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Let's start talking about this onerous religious trinity of social justice, identity, politics, and intersectionality. A lot of people, when we talk about this, don't have a good working definition of what you're driving at. So what is social justice to start with?
Well, you're right. A lot of people don't know how to define it, but they certainly know when they see it and they feel it around them. What it is a it's something between a religious movement and a political movement which seeks to weaponize all issues of identity and finds meaning in life by picking up identity battles and running with them very hard at anyone who is perceived even to be in their way. This is why increasingly in the media in recent years, and indeed in politics, the debates have become not about what politics used to be about, or indeed the media used to be about, but about people who have erred or strayed on specific new doctrines on sexuality, relations between the sexes, race, and a lot more. And so social justice is one of these terms that, of course, sounds beautiful. I mean, it sounds like it indeed has been set up in order to be unopposable. It's like multiculturalism. It sounds, what are you for if you're against it? Are you for uniculturalism? You know, if you're against social justice, you must be for social injustice. What it means is that by using these almost unopposable terms, people are able to smuggle in their own very doctrinaire political and social views. And at this stage, as I say, I think everybody feels it and can feel it around them, not least in the assertions that are made daily with which we cannot all agree.
And I think what you just said about social justice is not only spot on, but it also is very commensurate with this whole idea of identity politics.
Yes, that's right. It's a triumvirate, as you say. Identity politics is how you take this basically to the polls. Identity politics is identifying groups by, as I say, sexual orientation, sex, race, and a bit more, and saying that this is the defining feature of everybody who has that characteristic, and you then group them together for a political aim. So, for instance, you say, well, we're going to coalesce all women to vote in a particular way, or we will need to get the gays on side, or blacks, and so on. And it's an incredibly reductive method of politicking, but both formally, particularly in America, and more informally in community activism, it's become the defining identity grouping of our time. I mean, much more so than, for instance, the discussions we used to have until fairly recently on class politics, which had their own drawbacks, to be certain, but this is a replacement of that.
And then the third, and I think in your book, if I recall correctly, you talk about this as being the most unhealthy part of this triad or this trinity, and that is the word intersectionality. Explain to those listening in what that term connotes.
It's probably the ugliest word in the English language, with some of the ugliest connotations at this stage as well. It's an invention of American academia, I'm sorry to say, which claims that it takes up this first issue, the social justice issue, and it says we must fight against burning injustice. But intersectionalism says, this theory says, that's been around for about 40 years or so, it's not enough to fight against one burning injustice. For all injustice in the world is interlocked, and we must fight against all injustices and work out where they are and where they interlock.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Douglas Murray. The Madness of Crowds by Douglas Murray is an eviscerating exposé of the defining issues of the 21st century: sexual orientation, feminism, race, and transgenderism. Murray makes it clear that the leftist agents of the culture war do not aim to slightly alter society. They intend to completely disrupt and destroy Western civilization in the name of social justice. The Madness of Crowds is a must-read in order to realize what will rise from the ashes if we don't alter course and deconstruct the counterfeit claims of the social justice agenda. To receive your copy of The Madness of Crowds, Gender, Race, and Identity, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. With the new atheists increasing their mockery of Christianity and militant secularism ridiculing religious convictions of all stripes, we clearly don't need zealous but misguided Christians inviting further abuse by misreading and misrepresenting biblical prophecies. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will enable you to understand, remember, and communicate biblical prophecy. Moreover, your investment in Prophetic Stars through the Christian Research Institute will equip and encourage eager Christian brothers and sisters who genuinely yearn for truth and reliable tools to apprehend and defend their faith. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.
Many Americans feel their religious freedom is under attack. They see the culture changing and fear their beliefs will soon be punished as a form of bigotry. Others think these fears are overblown and say Christians should stop complaining about imaginary persecution. In Free to Believe, leading religious freedom attorney Luke Goodrich combines frontline experience with faithful attention to Scripture to show why religious freedom matters, how it is threatened, and how to protect it. With penetrating insights on gay rights, abortion, Islam, and the public square, Goodrich argues that threats to religious freedom are real, but they might not be quite what you think. To receive your copy of Free to Believe, The Battle Over Religious Liberty in America, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit us at equip.org.
Well, let's rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and journalist Douglas Murray in their conversation.
Intersectionalism says it's not enough to fight against one burning injustice, for all injustice in the world is interlocked, and we must fight against all injustices and work out where they are and where they interlock. Now, the claim is, as I say, that the whole of society is set up like an interweaving web of oppression, and that if we understand where these oppressions interconnect, we can undo them at the same time. So, for instance, it's not enough to campaign for the right of trans people to live their lives. We must campaign for black trans women who are being murdered. And therefore, we must campaign for all of the racial, sexual, and gender issues that come along with that. And that you can only understand one of these things if you understand all. It presumes that we live in a very racist, patriarchal, cis-heteronormative, as the saying would go, societies, which are unbelievably oppressive, and that we don't really quite understand how oppressed we are, but we're more oppressed the more you look at it, the theory goes, and we've just got to keep digging down into this oppression until we overthrow the whole thing. This is an enormous set of presumptions, apart from anything else to make about a society like America or like Britain, where I'm from. But this is the intersectional claim. It perceives life as a set of struggles to overthrow oppressions. And as I say, it means that people can throw themselves into battles that have nothing to do with their own lives, but that's precisely why it makes them even more virtuous when they engage in such battles.
I love the way that your book is outlined. You have four major chapters. You have a chapter on gay, one on women, one on race, and one on trans. And then between those chapters, you have interludes, one being the Marxist foundations, the next being the impact of technology, the third being on forgiveness, which is very fascinating, and then a conclusion to the entire book. I want to start out with that first chapter in which you write about how rapidly perspectives on marriage are changing. And one of the illustrations is the idea of same-sex marriage. So you have Hillary Clinton back at the time that her husband was proffering the Defense of Marriage Act. She was standing behind that lockstep with her husband. Then when she ran for office in 2016, she was standing diametrically opposed to this. And I suppose that underscores how rapidly our culture is transitioning, and how if you have happened to say something in the past, even if that past is fairly recent, you have a tripwire there that can blow you up pretty quickly.
Yes, that's right. I give the example of Joy Reid, who was found a couple of years ago to have done a tweet 10 years earlier in which she had expressed her reservations about gay marriage. And at the time she tweeted that, that was quite a common to be, you know, not in favor of gay marriage. And it was just very interesting that within a decade, this was enough to put her career in serious peril. And what I'm interested in about this really is it's a very good signal of the speed at which we are shifting our views. By the way, I happen to be in favor of gay marriage in a civil context. And what I say is, and what I think I mentioned in that chapter is, there's a very interesting boot on the other foot test here. Because if it is the case, and I give an example of an event I attended, a Christian event in London, which was basically hounded out of the venues it was trying to organize in, if we end up in a situation of saying that people who are not in favor of gay marriage, which includes, as I say, most people until very recently, if in this era it becomes impermissible to hold a view that was held very commonly until yesterday, we are doing something very dangerous, we are doing actually something profoundly illiberal. And we are saying that the mores of our time happen to have changed very radically on a set of things, whether for the good or for the worse is in people's own views, but that as they change, we will be totally unforgiving of anyone who doesn't come along lockstep with it 100% of the way. That, as I say, is a profoundly illiberal thing. It is not the job, for instance, of rights campaigners of any kind, writers or anyone else, to tell congregations or leadership of churches and other religious institutions to go along with views that those institutions do not and in many cases cannot hold. And I give the gay marriage one because it's a fascinating window into this. The unforgivingness of our time, the unwillingness to allow a variety of genuinely various and dissenting opinion, and the desire effectively just to jump orthodoxies, where yesterday we had one, today we'll have a new one. And woe betide you if you're not on the right side today.
You self-identify as gay. And I'm wondering, when you write about the problems with the gay agenda or the gay movement at various junctures, does that give you more credibility or less credibility in terms of the broader swath of people that you're trying to speak to?
I've no particular idea, because I never write like that and I never think like that. I've always tried as a writer to say what I think is true. And that has always led me into lots of problems. I decided to do the gay chapter first because, in a way, one of the reasons was that there's a foundational thing there that is needed to be explained. But the, as it were, tactical reason of doing it first was to say, look, I am willing to speak and think absolutely openly and freely through very difficult terrain on the only one of these identity questions that actually treads on my life. So if I'm willing to do it on the one that I could claim to be involved with, then do trust me that I'm going to do the same thing on others, and that when I do it on others, it's with no nefarious intent. You know, you have to prove to people these days that you're not some hidden homophobe, racist, sexist, you know, et cetera. And I wanted to show people, as it were, to build confidence with my readers, to say, look, the fact is there's an awful lot of stuff we don't know about, and there's an awful lot of stuff we do know about, which we pretend not to know about. And there's an awful lot of just very complex things which we ought to not pretend are simple or straightforward. You know, it just isn't the case, for instance, that LGBT is just a sort of happy mini alphabet that requires no further elucidation or thought. It's not the case, as I say in the chapter about relations between the sexes, that things are quite as straightforward as we sometimes pretend today. Nor, by the way, is it quite as complex as we are telling a new generation that it is.
Talk about the current dogma that being gay is wholly inbuilt and an unmovable state of being. This is something I was fascinated to see you write about very candidly. This is a dogma that is being communicated broadly, but you're saying that this is not settled science by any stretch of the imagination.
That's right, it isn't. And this, of course, makes a lot of people incredibly uncomfortable. But, I mean, I'm interested in things that make us uncomfortable because those are the things that are interesting. Within most of our lifetimes, there was a commonly heard phrase that was used about being gay, which was that it was a lifestyle choice. And that was particularly came from religious figures. There was something off with it, which a lot of people could notice, which was that if it was a lifestyle choice, why would people choose it? Because it makes people's lives rather more difficult than they needed to be. So it's an odd thing to choose. Now, as it happens, over the decades, we've come to a different settlement, which is what I jokingly describe as the Lady Gaga agreement, which is born this way. Now, as I say, the book came out actually just weeks before the largest study into this ever carried out was carried out by some American academics. And it actually bolstered the argument I make in the book, which is basically we don't really know, even at this stage, we don't really know why some people are attracted to their own sex. And it's a very complex area. It's highly unlikely we're going to discover a single gay gene. But it's also, by both the American and British Psychological Association's views, could involve some combination of genetics and issues to do with life experience. So what I say is, since we don't know very much about this, and by the way, I should stress, this has nothing to do with, you know, depriving anyone of rights or anything like this, but I say, since we don't know very much about this, ought our societies to be leaning quite so hard on a presumption which we actually aren't sure about? Ought we to be quite so assertive about things that actually remain slightly opaque? Now, I completely understand why campaigning groups, for instance, might want to pretend that we know more about the science than we do. But it's just not quite honest. And here is one of the problems with it. It's always been my observation throughout the many books and articles I've written throughout my life so far, that there's a great danger in leaning heavily on things you don't know enough about. But what it allows, among other things, is for other people to come in and also assert things based on not enough evidence.
We've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we will continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with acclaimed journalist Douglas Murray. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowds: Gender, Race, and Identity. Just call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Don't forget, you can also write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The preceding program was pre-recorded. Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.